Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mary Cranston, immediate past chair of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, the senior partner of the law firm of Pillsbury, Winthrop, Shaw, Pittman, and your moderator for tonight's program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speakers, Joanna Barsh and Susie Cranston, executives with the firm of McKinsey & Company, and authors of the new book, How Remarkable Women Lead, The Breakthrough Model for Work and Life. Joanna Barsh is a senior partner at McKinsey and a leader of the firm's consumer, retail, and organizational practices. She began interviewing women in 2004, and by 2007, she knew she was onto something. She created the Centered Leadership Project in 2007, and with Susie Cranston and others, built a global program that is now integral to McKinsey's organization practice and is the genesis of the book, How Remarkable Women Lead. Joanna serves a range of McKinsey's clients, consumer, retail, media, and private equity. I can't give you the names or I'd have to kill you. She is a passionate contributor to her New York community, including serving as a commissioner on the New York City Commission on Women since 2002, and working with a range of organizations, which include the American Museum of Natural History, the Manhattan Theater Club, and St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. She has numerous awards for her many contributions, including a top award from the Girl Scouts and the New York Women's Agenda. She has degrees from the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Chicago, and her MBA is from Harvard. And most importantly, actually, she is the mother of two future remarkable women leaders, Gabby and Jetta. Susie Cranston is an expert within McKinsey's organizational behavior practice, working with clients on sustainable and comprehensive talent management programs and on effective change management systems. She was part of the working team that developed Centered Leadership, and she continues to work with Joanna as they carry out further research and expand the concepts within McKinsey. She's a frequent speaker on the topic of women in leadership. Susie is a native of San Francisco and has two degrees from Stanford, a bachelor's in engineering and an MBA from the Stanford Business School. And in case you're wondering about the overlapping names and the fact that Susie looks like me except she's 6 inches taller, she is, in fact, my daughter. So please join me in welcoming Susanna Barsh, Joanna Barsh and Susie Cranston.
Barsh or Cranston. Neither. Susie and I are exactly alike, except for one thing.
I'm a little taller.
Yeah, there you go. So Centered Leadership started, as Mary said, back about the time when I was turning 50. And I know that nobody in this room has ever turned 50, and so you probably wouldn't know this, but I woke up that morning, and something happened. Something was missing in my life. And I love my two daughters. They're perfect. I have a husband I love dearly. I live in a really nice apartment with a great view in New York City. I really like my job. Why was I feeling this? So I went to my husband, David, and I'll tell you a little bit about him tonight, but he's a commando type. And I said, David, I have this pit in my stomach. And he said, it's midlife crisis. Go buy yourself a pair of shoes. So I did. I bought a really nice pair of shoes. And 2 weeks later, the feeling came back. And yes, I did buy another pair of shoes. And at that point, I realized it wasn't going to work, and my closet was full. So I turned to other women from around the world, senior women, who I thought would teach me what it was that I was missing. And that if I could find what they had and put it all together and bottle it and drink it, I would feel better. And then I could give you that bottle, and you could drink it too. And David, thank God we had a man on the project. David said, give the project a really big name. And so if you look up there, the McKinsey Leadership Project Centered Leadership, very long name, lots of letters, and in fact it did what he said it should do, which is it got the men to look up and say, what's this about? This must be important. So that's when we brought Susie and a team on board.
So being McKinsey, we couldn't just let this stop at interviews. We obviously had to go and dig through all the data we could find and all the academic research that was out there. So we started by looking at the traditional leadership literature that was out there. And Joanna likes to say that we read 5 books and decided there was nothing good out there. I would like to say we read quite a few more than 5 books, but nothing really captured what we were looking for when we tried to understand what the essence was of these successful women leaders that we saw. So we decided to look elsewhere, and we started looking at organizational development work. And we found a lot of really interesting things about how you connect and how you build networks. But again, nothing that really explained the essence of what we were seeing in these interviews with women from around the world. So moving on from organizational design, we decided to look at evolutionary science and brain science. And there were some really fascinating findings that we'll talk to you about tonight that show differences in male and female brains and evolutionary reasons why men and women approach things differently. But even with biological kind of brain science approach, it turned out that the difference between men and women from a brain standpoint is actually less significant than the deviation amongst a single gender. So the difference between two different women's brains is actually more sizable than the difference between men and women's brains on average. So we continued the search. And we finally landed upon positive psychology. So I'm not sure if anybody here is familiar with the positive psychology movement, but we found some really terrific thinking about how you handle emotions and how you express emotions in a really authentic way. And the combination of all these different sources was really what led us to come up with this model. And the interviews that we did with that started with Joanna were really kind of what brought it all together. And so what we'd like to do now is actually show you a little bit of the videos that we did with the women. So you can kind of come back with us to the start of Centered Leadership when we were interviewing successful women from around the world.
So about 7 minutes. Enjoy.
When you look around the world and you see your friends who are happy in their careers, the ones that are happiest, I think, have done the best job of self-assessment. You know, they know who they are, they know what their value system is, and they make the decisions accordingly. And because I think this is a marathon, this is not a sprint.
I did a very rigorous analysis of my happiness or my utility. I created an Excel spreadsheet. This was a very McKinsey analysis, which I thought was completely normal. I think to non-McKinsey people, they found it completely neurotic. Laid out all my variables that are important to me. And I discovered something pretty shocking, which is that the worst case scenario of being a filmmaker, at the end of the day, I was still going to be happier than being in the best case of being a businesswoman. So that was when it was clear to me. And I thought, well, wow, I have to, what am I doing here?
I remember one instance where the person who was working directly for me, and she came to me and said, do you want to be a vice president? And my response was, I couldn't care less. I want to make something great for kids. That's what I'm focused on. And she said, well, if you have so little ambition, I'm going to get another job. And I said, you should do that. And I have plenty of ambition, but it's not a self-centered ambition. It's an ambition to actually change something. And that was just unthinkable to her.
Sometimes failure fuels success. I mean, to me, I've learned more from the setbacks because it makes me much more reflective than the ones that seem like, well, okay, I did that, so what's next? And you don't think about those as much.
You walk into a meeting, you're a black female. I mean, these are white executives. They look at you and they think, she doesn't know anything. There's absolutely nothing she can help me with. And I remember specifically one of it's a listed company in Zimbabwe, one of the clients was actually quite rude and didn't think I would be able to perform, and he didn't relate to me very well in the meeting, but I just responded politely. After the meeting, he actually made a few phone calls to me, screamed at me over the phone, you don't know what you're doing, you're this, that, and the other. But I maintained my cool, and I just responded in the manner that I thought I should. And put the phone down. Lo and behold, my managing director came to me with a letter saying, the client was so impressed by you. He said he let loose, but you were very calm and you maintained yourself and you still managed to execute
And they were very impressed. I actually ended up getting an award from Standard Chartered London.
What I bring more now in the equation is the emotional intelligence around leading the people through this kind of change, the very same people that didn't think we could do it, who could do it. And that took a lot of one step forward, five step back. We'd get a little bit there, then there would be passive resistance. I would realize that I really never got them emotionally engaged. You realize that in small nuances. And over a period of time, when you wake up one morning and say, aha, no one's really doing this.
When I was a second-year associate, I was working for a consumer products company, and the chairman called one of the managing directors at the time and said, we need a woman in the boardroom, and we want her to present because we're a women's consumer products company, and that's important to us. And so he said, okay, you're going to present. I'd never been in a boardroom, let alone present in a boardroom, and I was petrified. And he said, well, sink or swim, you're in, go. And it was awesome. It was absolutely terrific. I know exactly, I can to this day remember the mistake I made, but I can remember it was overall good. He took a risk on me, and I've had people who've taken risks throughout my career.
I don't think that I'm a thrill seeker. What I like to say when you're skiing, because I like to jump off cliffs, but I generally jump off cliffs that I'm relatively confident I'm going to land, and that if I don't, it's not dangerous. I like to be at that point where you're there and you're about to jump and your stomach is kind of going,
Challenges must be there. Obstacles must be there. But you must be determined that, look, this is a challenge before me and I'm going to cross over it. It is when you cross over it that you get promoted to the next level. But so long as you don't cross it, well, it stands as a mountain before you.
I would say trust your intuition and talk to the people that you really care about in the short term, but also in the long term, and find out what they think about it. Shake it up and decide for yourself.
I just love a debate. And the best thing that happens is when a first-year lawyer comes and starts arguing with you on a legal proposition, and he holds his own, you know, sentence for sentence. And they see that bubbliness in me when that happens. And there's an enthusiasm that they recognize, and it's quite infectious.
I was a national champion at the age of 13. But I started training when I was 10, and I was a bench player. I was always the tea lady for the first 3 years. Actually, I was not a very competitive person at all when I was in school. And then, you know, by sitting there and watching other people win, and then the applause and the stand-up ovation, all of that was quite inspiring. So I said, maybe that's a good feeling. Maybe I should try harder. So I tried harder.
You cannot be afraid to be who you are. I mean, live your values, live your life. I had a woman ask me the other day about, she used the term sneaking out of the office to go to a child's play. You know, that's how she described her own behavior. And I said, well, wait, stop right there, stop. I said, I have never snuck out of any place. I walk right down the center hall, and if anybody doesn't like it, too bad. I mean, this is what I need to do to lead my life. This is what I want to do. And I'm going to the school play at 11:15. Don't worry about me. I'll get my job done. I will deliver whatever people need. But don't sneak. You know, just kind of stand up, do what you need to do, and smile about it. And look them in the eye and go, you know, if you don't like it, fire me. And I'll go find another job because I'm talented enough, and I'm committed enough, and I'm smart enough.
Yes! I had to do that. I had to do that. Let's start with meaning. Meaning is the anchor of all of centered leadership, because meaning is so important to us women, and to many men too, but even more important to women. And meaning starts with happiness. Do you know where your happiness comes from? Raise your hand if you woke up most days as a child happy. So most people, that's a large part of your happiness. But there's another big piece of it. If you didn't raise your hand, there's hope. And that is, what are the activities that you choose to do? Do they engage you? To the extent that they engage you, you will in fact release new energy and find greater happiness than even a new pair of shoes.
And that is one of the secrets of centered leadership. But there's more. Go on to find your strengths. And I don't mean you're a good communicator, you're a great financial analyst, you love to multitask 1,400 things in a day and get them all done, you deal with a crappy boss, and gosh, you're incredibly patient. These are strengths that you have today at work. What were the strengths you had as a child that you still have deep, deep within today? Get back to, is it bravery? Is it kindness? Is it curiosity? What is it? And find those strengths. And third, find out what's important to you. Find out what your purpose is. This may be a lifetime of asking yourself that question, or you may already know it today. But when you put together what makes you happy, what your strengths are, and what's important to you, and find the pattern, therein lies your own individual meaning.
And it's interesting because the way that Joanna and I came about finding meaning as the core element of this framework is that we looked at these interview transcripts, and person after person after person commented that the reason they did what they did is because they just found their job so incredibly meaningful. And this pattern came up again, and we started thinking, well, what's going on here? And we looked at the research, and it turns out that if you ask men and women around the world what they value most in a job, the answer is not the same. So women will say that they are motivated to get up and go to the work in the morning by the quality of the people they work with, by the quality of the work they produce. They find meaning in what they do. Men find themselves more motivated to go to work in the morning because of pay, status, and elements that have less to do in the traditional sense with meaning. So we figured out that meaning was important. We could sort of start to see that pattern was consistent for women. But then the question was, how do you find meaning, right? I mean, people have been searching for the meaning of life for centuries. And we were really relieved when we came across some research on strengths, because it turns out that people who use their natural strengths on a regular basis and integrate that into what they do are happier and find meaning much more easily than others.
So let me tell you and admit tonight, I feel like a little bit I need to make this admission. I've been at McKinsey 28 years, and I thought, how come they never made me a leader? Was it because I wasn't tall? Was it because I had a high, squeaky voice? So I took a strengths assessment, which Susie will tell you about. And there are 24 core universal strengths. And I thought, leadership's on there. It's going to be number one. I'm going to bring it in and show it to all my partners. And they're going to say, Joanna, you're right. You should be a leader. So I put my daughters around me, and I took the test. And I was devastated. My number one strength is industriousness and perseverance. So glamorous. My children looked at me and said, Mom, this is you. You're always in the kitchen. You should have been a housekeeper. You'd be so happy. So I brought my husband, David, which I love dearly, and he's a mathematician. And he said, this is just for girls. This stuff is baloney. And I said, no, it's not. Why don't you take the assessment, Mr. Big Guy? So he took the assessment. His number one strength is loving and being loved. And we gave him a hug. We gave this guy a hug, and it turns out he's always asking for a hug because it's his strength. It makes him happy to hug his daughters and his wife. So it goes to show you, don't stereotype. Think about who you are and what makes you strong, and then put it to work.
And if you guys are now inspired to either take the test yourself or perhaps have your significant other take the test, it turns out there's actually a free place online you can go to. It's authentichappiness.org. And if you take the long version of the test, you can find out what your own personal signature strengths are.
On to framing. Framing is about optimism. Are you an optimist? Are you a pessimist? And we don't mean, gosh, if we all scrunch our eyes up really, really tight and we believe that the world is a beautiful place, it will become so. That's the power of positive thinking. Put that out of sight. What we mean are three lenses. Three lenses. How do you look at good events? How do you look at bad events? Do you make them personal or do you make them situational? Do you make them temporary or do you make them long-lasting? Do you make them specific or do you make them pervasive your whole life? So think about a good event. Think about a bad event. And how do you frame the world?
And there's actually a couple extra benefits for being optimistic. It turns out that optimistic people are happier, they're healthier, and people find them more attractive. So there's lots of benefits to being an optimist. And for those of you that didn't raise your hand as waking up naturally happy, who may be on the more pessimistic side of things, no names, the good news is that we actually found a lot of different ways that you can actually cultivate and train yourself to be more optimistic.
So I'll admit, I am actually a pessimist, and this has eaten away at me for so many years of my life. The good news is you can train to be an optimist. But here's what happens. Has anybody ever done this? Am I alone here in this group? It's called the downward spiral. Here's how it works. I'm in a client meeting, and I'm saying to myself, oops, this is not going well. In fact, it's really going badly. In fact, and then the little voice, you know the little voice we all have in our heads? It's my mother. That little voice is saying, I think you put on 5 pounds, you know, and it's going. And I'm heading down, and I'm thinking, I'm actually a lousy consultant. In fact, the CEO just left the room. I think he's going to call up the people at McKinsey to get me fired. And because we're women, and Susie will explain this in a minute, I am so going down. The next thought I have is my husband doesn't love me anymore. And I'm really now heading down. I yelled at my children this morning. I'm a bad mother. I have no right to live. And I'm down there. And I stay down there. And then what happens? Middle of the night, I wake up and I ruminate. Tell us about rumination.
So has anybody here experienced this downward spiral that Joanna mentioned? Yeah.
Thank you.
Most of us have. And it turns out that there's actually some real kind of brain-based reasons why this often happens for women. So how many women here feel like they are excellent multitaskers? Okay, so most of us. So it turns out that the ability to multitask is related to the these things in our brain called associations. So women tend to remember things easily by grouping memories, essentially. So one memory will trigger a memory of 5 other memories. And what happens when you ruminate, and this has been proven scientifically, is that one negative emotion brings up the 5 most recent traumas of your life. Hence, Joanna has a bad meeting, and she's a bad mother, her husband doesn't love her, all these, you know, other traumas are coming into her mind. And the good news for Joanna, she was really thrilled when we discovered this in the research, is that there's some really easy techniques that you can use to pull yourself out.
So, has this ever happened to you at 2 in the morning, you wake up and you go, oh, if I'd only said, and then the next morning you tell your partner or spouse, I can't get this out of my mind, and the next afternoon you tell your coworker, and you know you're ruminating. Because 5 days later, somebody looks at you and says, would you please stop telling me that story? I've already heard it 20 times. Thank you very much. Who loves to ruminate here as I do? And who else ruminates? Anybody know? Cows, right? Cows ruminate. So not a good thing. How do we get over that?
So it turns out, for those of you that find yourself ruminating, that one of the simplest ways to get out of the rumination is to dispute the facts, or dispute your interpretation of the facts, I should say. So think about a challenge in your life and ask yourself, are you really being objective about the facts? So the CEO stood up and he walked out of the room. Did he really walk out of the room because he didn't like what you were saying? Maybe he ate something bad for lunch. Maybe his wife's going into labor. There's lots of different interpretations of a given situation. So I really encourage anybody who finds himself ruminating to sit down, think about what you're upset about or what's bothering you, and really objectively debate with yourself what is your interpretations and what are the facts of the situation. And if you need to, get some friends to help you out as well.
There's one more piece of framing we'd love to leave you with, and that's reframing. Look at the person next to you or the person closest to you who you don't know at all, and imagine that person to be an iceberg floating next to you, a little bit chilly. What does that mean? It means that the only thing you know about that person is what he or she says and how he or she acts. That's all you know. And by the way, you're now making a judgment. Oh, gosh, I really like your scarf. You must be a very nice person. Or, turquoise. I could never wear turquoise. You must be courageous. And now we're making judgments all over the place. But below the water of that iceberg are the thoughts and feelings that person has that you are not privy to. Below that are the values the person has that you don't really know. Below that, what does this person need? What are the unmet needs of this person? And finally, what is this person afraid of? If you start to think about other people as icebergs and yourself as one as well, two things will happen. One, you'll stop judging so quickly until you really delve in. And the second thing is the person will become a human being. From iceberg to human being, as opposed to just that jerk or that person who's bothering me. So that's it for framing.
That's it for framing. So moving on to connecting, once you start to be able to figure out what's going on under the iceberg, that's actually one of the big enablers for connecting. And it turns out that women and men actually approach networking in a slightly different manner. So when you analyze men's networks, they tend to be much broader, and they tend to be less deep. So they know more people, but not as well. Women, on the other hand, tend to know fewer people, but they know them very, very well. And we actually think there's some evolutionary reasoning behind this. So back in the, I don't know, Middle Ages, it was much more likely for women to have children than for men. Men actually had to go out, find their fortune, become wealthy enough to have children, whereas women, by definition, were able to have children always. So what that meant is that men, by definition, sort of had to have this broader network, and women tended to have to stay home and perhaps be more focused on fewer people. So there's actually some evolutionary science that sort of suggests why this might be the case.
So here's how it works. Back to my ever-loving husband, David. He said to me just about 3 weeks ago, he came back from TED, and he was really fired up, and he said, I need to call my friend Peter about this new idea I need him to invest in. And I said, gee, Peter, I've never heard that name. He's your friend. And he said, yeah, I met Peter about 5 years ago at a pickup soccer game in Central Park. And I looked at him, and ladies, I said, he's not your friend. You don't know his hopes and dreams. You don't know if he has a wife and children. You don't even know his last name. And David said, I know that he loves soccer. What more do I need to know? And he's right. Peter was a friend, but for me, not. Because the difference between men and women, and we tend not to use reciprocity as a result to build friendships. The difference is that we build very deep relationships, and then we don't like to impose. And that's something that we could get over. That's really something in our way. And reciprocity is typically the stumbling block. Reciprocity, Jonathan Haidt will tell you, is the glue that creates society. But what men will say, you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours, and hey, that's cool. There's nothing wrong with that. One man this week said to me, you know, I think of relationships as a virtual bank. I give to you, I make deposits into this bank, and, you know, at some point, I'll call you up and make a withdrawal. And I thought, great. How many women here think about their relationships as virtual banks? We got one. Fantastic. Because reciprocity is fabulous. And we should all be using it because it will help us grow.
And for those of you that are interested in thinking more about connecting and how you can leverage your own networks, we actually recommend that you spend some time actually drawing out your network. So get out a big map and actually draw out all the people that you interact with on a regular basis. And think about, you know, who's what best position to help you develop? Who's best position to be that person that sort of helps you get into the next echelon of your career? And make sure that you're actually actively investing and reciprocating with those people. Because women often sort of feel like networking is something, we talk to women and they feel like it's sleazy or something that you just do at a conference with people you don't care about. And that's really not the case. You can actually be a genuine, authentic, kind person and think really proactively about how you connect.
One more thing. Mentors and sponsors. Who here has a sponsor? Who is a sponsor? More of us need sponsors and more of us need to be sponsors. What's the difference? I'm a big fan of Star Wars. Is anybody here a fan of Star Wars? Great. Yoda has mentored, David calculated, about 1 billion people in the world. He is probably the world's all-time best mentor ever. Do you remember what Yoda said? No? There is no try. There is only and do not. See? Five people already know that. And all of you take one thing away and you just do what Yoda says and you say there is no try, there is do and do not. You are going to be better off tonight than you were before you came. However, if you had a sponsor, you'd be a hell of a lot better off because a sponsor can only help two or three people at a time. And what is that sponsor doing for you? He or she is actually believing in you. It's already made the assessment. And he or she knows that you're going to be successful. then what is he doing? He's creating opportunities for you, opportunities to grow. And even if you say, I don't want to leave the plane, I don't think my parachute is going to open, he or she does this, and out you go, and your parachute opens. And you know what? If you need a little help on the ground, he or she is right there spreading that safety net. And you come down, and any mistakes you make are just covered up. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't it wonderful to have a sponsor? It's going to accelerate our growth. How would you find one?
So in thinking about a sponsor, what you really want to do is think about who is it that is in a position to sort of help you achieve that next level of success. And then think about what does that person care about. So a lot of times we talk to women and they say, well, I know somebody's senior, but I have nothing to offer them. I'm not senior enough. What can I offer? But the thing is, there's always something you can offer. You can offer to, you know, introduce them to some other people that they might find interesting. You can send them an article that they might find interesting. There's a lot of proactive things that you can actually do, even if you, you know, aren't a fellow CEO, that can sort of help build that relationship. And it's interesting that Joanna mentioned sponsors pushing you out of the airplane, because that actually relates really nicely to engaging, which is the next topic of our model.
Engaging is about fear. It starts with finding your voice. Who here feels they can really stand up and state what they believe in, even if it's unpopular? And if you're a lawyer, keep your hand down. Okay, for the rest of us, it starts with learning how to use our voice. And here's one tip, which I just love that I got from a woman at McKinsey, which is, next meeting you go to, write the names down of everybody in the meeting. You don't have to talk for 30 minutes, but you're going to score everybody for the first 30 minutes from 1 to 5, 1 being the stupidest thing you've ever heard, and 5 being, this is profound, this is changing the course of our discussion. After 30 minutes, average up all your scores, and what will you find? Chances are you'll find that you scored everybody 2.5 to 3.5, and you're setting your own bar too high. So that's the first thing to think about. And the second thing to think about is what's happening to us. Fear. Fear is stopping us from taking opportunity. In fact, in my case, it stopped me from seeing the opportunity. For 28 years, I missed so many great opportunities for my own growth and for the growth of people around me. I didn't see it. And so that goes right back to that spiral down thing we talked about. And the fear lies right beneath the risks, right? We're all good at saying, that's kind of risky, right? Oh, there's a lot of downside to that opportunity. And suddenly it doesn't look so good. But go deeper. Most of us have a fear of failure. Go deeper than that. I have a terrible fear of rejection. So I can be sitting in a client meeting and suddenly looking out at all, let's assume we're all in the same client meeting, and I'm looking out at all of you and I'm thinking, they're going to reject me. I'm going to say something stupid. And they're all looking at me now. Everybody, look at these people. They're looking at, now they're laughing at me. And now I'm going back down. And before you know it, I have caused my own fear to make the worst thing possible. Something I knew was going to happen, happened. And I gave control to my fear. What do I do about that?
So what Joanne is actually describing is something called the amygdala hijack. So has anybody ever heard of the amygdala part of your brain before? Okay. So hopefully a number of you are familiar with this idea that we have this ancient kind of, we call it the reptile part of your brain. And it's basically hardwired into your system to keep you safe. So when you're crossing the street and you hear the brakes squeaking and you hear this like, and like a car's, you know, careening towards you, you jump back without even thinking. And the reason you jump back so quickly is because of your amygdala. It is the fastest responding part of your whole entire self. And anytime you feel threatened, whether it's an actual physical threat of a car running into you or an emotional threat of being laughed at or feeling humiliated, that part of your brain kicks in. And that part of your brain overrides the rational part of your brain. It overrides everything else that's going on. And so what you need to do is you can feel when the amygdala hijack comes on, right? When you're in a meeting and something's going bad, you can feel kind of, you know, you tense up, maybe you get, you know, hot, or you can start to feel that amygdala emotional rush that comes through you. And there's actually some really simple techniques that you can use to turn that amygdala hijack off. So when Joanna starts to spiral down in front of an audience, we can just tell her, Joanna, take a deep breath.
Yeah.
And what we call is putting the pause on. And in taking that deep breath, what happens is it sort of starts to turn off that ancient part of your brain and engage the more rational frontal lobe, which allows you to sort of take a step back, get control of the situation, and continue on with your speech.
Thank you. And in the interest of time, I'm actually going to take us straight through to energizing. Are you guys, are with us, and will you do an exercise with us right now? Okay, so put your stuff down and stand up. And here's what's going to happen. You need both hands free, so if you're busy blackberrying anybody, pause for a moment. Susie and I are going to demonstrate. When we say go, you're going to turn to five different people around you. Hands are going to go up, and you're going to do a high five. But when you do this high five, you're going to yell anything that comes into your head, like,
awesome!
There you go. Everybody got that? Try it five times, five different people. Go.
All right.
You rock.
Good work.
Woohoo!
Way to go, Joanna.
Woo!
Awesome!
Woo! Okay.
All right.
Don't sit down. Don't sit down. Don't sit down yet. Hang on. Susie.
All right. On the count of three, I want everyone to yell out the name of your favorite trashy TV show, okay? One, two, three.
House MD! Okay, what's your favorite music group? Lady Gaga, scream it out!
We know what Joanna's is.
Okay, so how do you feel now? Raise your hand if your energy level, physical, emotional, spiritual, and mental, is the same or higher than it was before you started. Great.
Right.
And raise your hand if it's lower.
We always get a few.
We always get a few. Everybody can sit down now. Here's what's going on. My apologies to the folks who raised their hand that it was lower. Sometimes what energizes one person drains another. And often this gets you too far out of your comfort zone. Or you really like to be alone and you really like to be quiet. And that restores your energy. But for the rest of us, it's different.
That's right. So it turns out that in interview after interview, we talked to these women and we said, well, what about work-life balance? You know, give us your secrets. And every woman said, there is actually no such thing as work-life balance. And we were thinking, God, that's pretty depressing. And it turns out that it's not that there is no such thing as balance. It's just that the work-life balance model is a little bit flawed. So how many people here feel like they've done something at home with their families that they found extremely draining or tiresome? So something with the in-laws, taking the kids to Disneyland. I mean, most of us have done something in our home lives that was not super energizing. And how many of us have done something that we found incredibly energizing in the workplace? Something that was really exciting, that got us just happy to be there? Okay, so this model, which says you stay at home to energize yourself and you go to work to deplete yourself, is truly flawed. And it turns out that the kind of most up-to-date thinking that we can find on energy is all about what energizes you and what depletes you.
So think about two incredibly exciting experiences that truly filled you with energy and two very, very draining experiences. And then reflect on physically, where were you? Mentally, what were you working on? Emotionally, where was your head at? Spiritually or socially, where were you? And then find your own patterns. The only universal energizer is sleep. So if you're not sleeping enough, chances are you're heading towards a burnout. What we'd really love for you is to find flow. Flow is an amazing condition where time seems to stop. And you have under your control the ability to put the five levers into place. So set yourself a challenge that's truly motivating for you, and that you have the intrinsic motivation, and it's hard enough, but you do have the skills to do it. Give yourself the time and attention to be able to take that activity and really do it well. And then make sure you get feedback. So those are the conditions. It's a challenge. It's motivating to you. You have the attention span to actually do it, and you have the feedback as well, and finally, you have the skills to do it well. When you do that, time stops. Now, do it in a group, and you have created a truly, truly memorable experience, whether you're doing it at work or at home. It's something that everybody should have, and most of us only have it 5% of the time. So we'd love that for you.
So we've given you a really, really quick overview of the Centered Leadership Model. And I just want to end it on a little bit of a researchy note. But to go back to some of the proprietary research that we did, if you are good at one of these elements, our research says that you have a 20% chance of being a top performer, of being incredibly satisfied with your career, being incredibly happy in your job. But our research shows that if you could get that being good at one up to being good at three or four of those things, then your chances of being an incredibly satisfied and happy, successful leader go to 50 to 100%. So there's a really strong correlation with mastering these elements and with the chances of your own success and happiness in whatever form of leadership you want to define as leadership. And, you know, there's a reason that these themes came up over and over again in the interviews. And so we hope that as you watch the model tonight, that there were elements that, you know, resonated with you that you feel like you already are amazing at, and that there were some additional things that, you know, you're inspired to learn more about.
So I'd like to leave you with a thought. This is not like a diet. I've been on and off diets for most of my life. And with a diet, you deny yourself in order to become the person you think you ought to be. With this, you're actually bringing out who you are more and more. And as you become more the person who you are, you find that you've released whole new sources of energy, which is really important. You find that the people around you, as you learn optimism, are actually excited to be with you and gaining energy from you. The more you're connected, the more you feel like you belong, and the happier that will make you, because we women have a hormone, oxytocin, that gets released. The more you give your fear a name and you face your fear, the more in control you are, and that also leads to your own happiness. And the more you realize that it's about going where the energy is, and going away from the drainers, and I'd like to add particularly the energy vampires in your companies, then you're going to feel really, really good. And not only are you going to feel passionate about what you're doing, you're going to make everybody around you glad to be there too. So I think that's going to wrap up for now. We're going to turn it to our beloved hostess, Mary Cranston.
Thank you, guys. Thanks to Susie and Joanna. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guests today are business executives Joanna Barsh and Susie Cranston, who are discussing the leadership qualities of successful women. So let's get started. One question was, what was the most surprising thing that you learned? Both of you were experienced people before you started this process. What really opened your eyes in your research and your work?
So I have to say, I think one of the most surprising things I found is that happiness actually has an equation to go with it. So you can imagine as an engineer how thrilling this was for me to figure out. And to really internalize that, to find something meaningful in your career is actually one of the most powerful things you can do to increase your chances of succeeding. You know, I think sometimes people feel like there's appropriate paths to success that you should follow, and if you follow your heart, you may be jeopardizing your chances of, you know, quote-unquote success. And I thought that the amount of research out there that suggests otherwise was really, really helpful.
For me, the power of reframing was so unbelievable. It starts with realizing that about 119 of the 120 people I've interviewed are optimists. And one woman was not an optimist, but she trained herself to become one. And the second thing I learned is that when you use this iceberg and you start to reframe situations, you actually open up a solution space and you get what you would really like to have happen there. And you didn't have to fight and you didn't have to cry. It just happens. It was fabulous.
One of our audience members wanted to know what you found about style differences between men and women and issues that women may face as they develop their leadership skills and try to work their way up the corporate ladder.
Men and women differ in one unbelievable aspect, which, Susie, you know in the research, that women are twice as likely to experience emotion at the extreme as men. That doesn't mean that every woman in this room is experiencing a high degree of love or anxiety right now. What it means is that we are bringing love and happiness to the workplace, and we're also bringing fear and anxiety and threat. And most men are not. So when I grew up in the workplace, I was told to just suck it up, that just leave those emotions at the door. And you know what happens when you try to do that? They just grow inside of you like, you know, bread that's rising. And pretty soon they burst out of you in some great self-destructive element. And men look at you and they say, what's happening to her? Why is there fire coming out of her ears? What should we do? I'd really like to go home now.
Yeah, and, you know, I was going to mention on a related note, there's some really fascinating research on how men and women respond to feedback. So I don't know if this will resonate with you all, but the research suggests that on average, when men hear something negative in their review, their reaction is to say, you know, the guy that's giving me this review is really a jerk. So if he thinks I'm doing poorly, I actually probably means I'm doing great. This is fabulous news. And a woman might take a piece of negative feedback and go home, cry a bit, you know, beat herself up, spiral down. And, you know, I think that that was insightful because it really, there's some easy things that we can do, right? We can really pay attention to the positive parts of your review and write it down and make yourself read it over and over again because the positive parts are really important. And, you know, to remember that if you start to spiral down with your feedback, really think about those facts and dispute your interpretations.
You know, I have a series of questions from the audience about the fact that even today, many women leaders at the tops of organizations are on the staff side, not the line side, and that the pink collar route. And there's also research by Catalyst on gender stereotyping, men take charge, women take care. How does that fit into your work, and do you address that in your work, or what's your reaction to that?
So the women that we met were leaders in all walks of life, and most of them were heading up either a company or a firm that they had created if they were an entrepreneur, or they were doing something unbelievable in their lives. So we didn't bump into this issue. We do believe that if you look at just American corporations, you might find that to be the case. And it does go back to the fact that Susie gave you. Actually, it's not a fact. You think of the evolutionary biologists. They're probably sitting around drinking coffee. And after the 10th cup, they realize that men take more risks than women. But it does, all of that goes back to whether you've got testosterone flowing through your body or estrogen. And the testosterone, neuroscientists believe, will in fact create a greater tendency to take risk. As we all know, that's not always a good thing. But we women, who are more cautious and less of a risk taker, may in fact be opting for a more predictable workplace. We may be opting for more predictable hours. And that may be what's causing us to go in companies into staff jobs where we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. It's not such a bad thing. But we ought to also get the excitement and joy of taking risk. And for that, as you heard before, we need to understand the fear that's standing in our way.
I would just also say, I think one of the things that we heard women say, especially as this model's evolved and we've continued to do interviews, after we finished the interview, we'd share this model with the women that we were interviewing with. And a lot of very senior and very successful women who were in the line jobs, I would say, commented that they wish they had known this model earlier. And the reason for that is that if you look at the ways to combat gender stereotypes and biases, the model that we've come up with is really kind of one of the best strategies, I think, that women have collectively found over time for dealing with gender bias and gender stereotyping. And so I think the reason that, you know, Joanna said we didn't necessarily bump into it in the interviews is because the women that we interviewed were really sharing with us the strategies that they had found that worked over time.
You know, you've interviewed women leaders around the world. And there's a question here that's very interesting in light of that, which is that studies show that if you educate and empower women in developing countries, the countries become more stable. What would be your take on that, and why do you think that works that way?
Well, you know, it's interesting because as you mentioned, we actually have gone to a lot of developing countries and interviewed women. And I think, you know, part of what we see is that, you know, women really do invest a lot in their relationships. They invest a lot in their children. They invest a lot in their friendships. And one hypothesis I would have, I obviously haven't personally researched that topic in particular, but one hypothesis is that I think that the skill sets that, you know, get imbibed in women during the education process have a much bigger and higher likelihood of transferring into the community than they might in other situations.
So we took a team to Uganda, where we had the benefit of going into the jungle in very rural communities and talking to the women who are fundamentally changing the economics of their own lives and those of their community. And here's what they did. They were actually using a form of centered leadership. It was believing in the future to start with, believing that the future would be different than what you inherited, believing that you personally can make a difference, and then gaining some specific skills, be it hygiene or farming or learning how to write your name or knowing the difference between a 5 and a 10 so that when you sold your goods at market, you would get a fair price. And that made these women strong. And the final thing that they were doing is, and this was all through the Hunger Project, they came together as a community, and the community made them stronger. And this goes back, evolutionary biologists will tell you, back to ancient times when the reflexes you have when you're threatened by a wild beast is fight. Women couldn't do that because we had babies to take care of. Run away. You couldn't leave your baby and run. Or freeze, which, as you know, works with a wild beast but not with a wild mate. So there's a fourth reflex that women developed, which is to band together to become a collective, giant, living thing that could ward off that danger. That collective action as a women's community is so powerful that we hope, if you look out at the audience here, it's just inspiring to see so many women and a few good men in the same place. It's fantastic.
You know, there's a question actually that follows on from that, but it's the stereotype that sometimes women leaders become catty with each other and actually don't advance other women's careers. What was your experience in that, and have you seen that in your research?
So we do see that something on the order of 20% of women are not using this collective power and are thinking of their own individual achievement, which is okay, right? Because there's no law that says we should all give back. However, there's two things that happen to those women. The first is they honestly don't get the joy that comes from belonging. And the second thing is they're not building behind them. So when you take on the role and the responsibility of becoming a sponsor, you get the benefit of being sponsored, which accelerates your own growth because you get many more opportunities than you would if you developed them on your own. And you get the joy of seeing all these people growing. So yes, it is true, but it would be true for men as well, that not everybody actually pulls people up the ladder behind them.
Have you presented this material to groups with men, and what is the relevance of this material for men's leadership?
So it's a great question, and it turns out that this model is actually very relevant for men. So it turns out, if you think about the women we've interviewed, I mean, this is probably the first time that we have enough publicly recognized leaders around the world that you could do this kind of research. I mean, it's fairly recent that women have even achieved these levels of public recognition as leaders. And what these women have really done, and the reason I think that the leadership model was so consistent amongst these women, is they've really changed mindsets. They've changed mindsets about what leadership looks like. They've changed mindsets about what motherhood looks like. You know, they've been incredible change agents. And so it turns out that this model of leadership is one of the most effective ways you can actually lead change in an organization, whether you're male or female. And so we've actually started using this as the McKinsey model for change leadership, and this has become the model we use for our male and female clients in any type of change situation. And it resonates a lot with men. We only have three here tonight, but you guys can ask them later what they
more.
Think.
They're hiding in the back. They're hiding in the back. You know, we just this week, we had a group of 20 men we were training, and we asked them to do the strengths discussion. And this is something you might take home, which is to get together with three or four people and interview each other as to what it is that that truly is a core strength that you had as a child that you still have today. And what the men told us was very interesting. One fellow said, you know, I've been a friend of this guy sitting next to me for 10 years, and I've never had a conversation like this with him. I now know more about him than I did cumulatively over the time working together. It was not David, by the way. The second thing that somebody said is, I feel a little uncomfortable having this discussion because we never think about ourselves in this way. And a third said, you know what's so amazing to me is now that I know what this person's strengths are, I can actually use that to leverage in my team. This is an amazing tool that never would have occurred to me. So when we teach men, some of it's less intuitive, but it's still incredibly useful.
So there's a question from someone in the audience who probably will not put their hand up, but saying that they were at McKinsey in the 90s, and at that time the partnership had only 15% women, and worldwide only 9% of the partners were women. So is your research having an impact internally at McKinsey?
I think I'm the oldest living woman at McKinsey, and I'm still going strong, so that's good news. We have only been at this now for about 18 months. This is an innovation for us, and we believe for everyone. Every single piece of this is something you already know, or you've seen, or we found, or Susie found in the academic research. But when you put it all together, that's when magic truly happens. So we've started to train our folks, and what we're seeing happen is elements of sponsorship that were not there before. We've seen women being put into opportunities that they didn't have before. And we've also seen a lot of men stepping up and saying, I want some of this too. And you could argue that in today's world, where it's far more uncertain, where nobody's making the kind of money that they were making 5 or 10 years ago, you better have meaning, and you better have passion, and you better have community at work, because those are truly the rewards that will be longest lasting. And pay will not. So that's what we're seeing at McKinsey these days. And I think we have a fair number of women partners. I don't even remember the number, but it's we're getting up there. We're at catalyst level. We want to go well beyond that.
That's good. So why do you think we have not been able to elect a female president in the United States, even though we do need a lot of change?
You know, that's an interesting question coming from you, Mom. she was an avid Hillary supporter. I think that things really are changing. I mean, you know, we weren't able to elect Hillary, but you know, we actually did finally have a very serious contender for the presidency that was female. We have the first female Speaker of the House. I did this calculation a couple weeks ago that 8% of world leaders are now female. And so, you know, I don't know that I can isolate all the reasons why we haven't been able to elect one, but instead I guess I would say, you know, I think we are starting to do some of the things that will lead us in that direction.
Think about mandates. Think about Norway, and you know that I think the number is 40% of all board seats are mandated to be held by women. And the women weren't necessarily ready when this came to be, but they took those opportunities, and it takes us a short while to grow into those roles. In India, I don't know if anybody here has the raw data on this, but it was that 30% of all municipal seats would be held by women, and they just raised that to 50. In the very beginning when this happened, women were the puppets of their husbands or their brothers or their fathers. But these women are now being trained, and they're now standing up to actually take those roles. So the world is changing, and I have hope and optimism, something that I learned for the future.
Sounds great. We are at the Commonwealth Club of California. It's the radio program that you are listening to, and our guests today are Joanna Barsh and Susie Cranston, who are discussing the leadership qualities of successful women. In your research, did you find any generational differences in perhaps optimism or other approaches to business that influence your centered leadership model?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Joanne and I think we do believe that there are some generational differences. I mean, for one, you know, this next generation that's coming up has female role models. You know, there may not be 50% of CEOs, but there are some out there. And I think with every succeeding generation, as we have more and more women, I mean, if you look at the statistics right now, 60% of undergraduate degrees are given to women, over 50% of graduate degrees are given to women, over 50%, or actually at 50% of kind of mid-level management in corporations, those positions are held by women. So, you know, the numbers are certainly shifting, and I think with that, the mindsets that women have about what's possible and how to do it are shifting.
One thing that's not different is that the five elements are relevant whether you are 15 or 50, and you may have grown past them, as I have been working on. You may have built your own capability to be a centered leader, but we all share. These are elemental factors. We all want meaning. We all learn to frame, and when we reframe, we really have power. We all get a benefit from connecting. So it doesn't matter. I use my daughters, who are now 13 and a half and 18, and the 18-year-old, as an example, was so afraid of college. And you know, Mary, because you've been helping me on this. And Gabby was so, so afraid that she would cry rather than go up and do a college tour. And once we broke it down and we figured out what she was afraid of and put it aside, she was able to go and have a truly great experience. And so it works on an 18-year-old. Who here has children at home? And who has children at home who can talk? Okay, so this is for you. This is for you because this works on boys and girls, and I really, really feel passionate about this one. It's called Three Good Things. Tonight, when you go home, maybe you're going to go home too late, but most nights for the next 3 weeks, put your kid to bed and ask him or her, what are three good things that happened today? They don't have to be the best things. Just what are three good things? Don't judge it. Just appreciate it. And then ask, tell me, is there one not so good thing that happened today? And appreciate that. And step back and say, oh, 3-1. We're really in good shape. What are you doing? Over the 3 weeks, you're retraining your brain and your child's brain, because our brains are very plastic, and they can be retrained to stop scanning for anxiety and things that are going to eat you in the night and start looking for good things. And it will subconsciously, your brain will look for good things, and your daughter will grow up stronger than you are.
More optimistic, yeah. There's a question here about meaning, which obviously is focusing on internally authentic things that appeal to each individual. But there's also a lot of advice, even in your book and in others, to focus more on negotiating for yourself and the practical aspects. Do you see any inconsistency, or how does that all play together?
So inconsistency between going after what you want and
yeah.
doing something that's internally right, but then having to negotiate for it.
Exactly.
Well, I you know, as one of the creators of the model, it's always hard for me to see inconsistency. But you know, I think what we're really trying to get at is that when you find something that's incredibly meaningful for you, you need to give yourself the permission to go after it and to ask for it. And what we find is that women are fantastic negotiators when it comes time to negotiate on behalf of somebody else. So, you know, if your client or your child or somebody in your family needs something, you will drive the hardest bargain you possibly can. But when it comes time to asking for something that you want, something that you care about really personally, it can be a whole other story. And that can feel really frightening for a lot of women. And so when we talk about engaging, the idea is to be consistent with what's really authentically motivating you and to actually have the courage to go after it and to speak up about what it is that you want. And to not let that fear that you sometimes can't even name sit inside you. It's interesting. One of the tips that we give women at McKinsey and that we train around the world, really, about how to deal with those fears is to actually name your fear. And a lot of times when you name your fear, you realize how ridiculous it is, right? So, you know, oh, well, I'm not going to ask for that opportunity because, you know, people might think I'm selfish. And you tell a friend that you're, you know, not going to ask because you're afraid people might think you're selfish. And your friend says, I can't even believe you think that. That's just laughable, right? And so if you feel like, you know, you're being held back by something, really naming that fear, talking about it with people, and finding the voice to sort of achieve what you find incredibly meaningful, that's what we mean by engaging.
Daniel Gilbert says that what you imagine to be the worst thing that will happen is so much worse than what will likely happen. So just give it a try.
So unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where there's time for only one last question. So let me just ask both of you what you most want the people who have come out today to hear you speak take away from this.
You know, the real motivation for why I decided to do this at McKinsey is I felt like if we could have an environment where, you know, there was just diversity and 50% women and 50% men, that would be incredible. And so what I hope is that in 20 years, when we're all back at the Commonwealth Club listening to somebody talk about leadership, that we have something closer to 50-50 and that everybody here has taken something away that can help not only shape your own leadership course, but the leadership course of people that you mentor and touch. So
I hope that you won't have to wait 50 years to have these thoughts, and that you will build your skills, and that your daughters won't even have to wait 30 years to have these thoughts, and that the strength that you take out of this room tonight will enable you to take one step towards that future, and that you'll enjoy your future and enjoy the steps along the way and not just hold your breath and wait till you've gotten there.
So our thanks to Joanna Barsh and Susie Cranston, authors of the new book, How Remarkable Women Lead, The Breakthrough Model for Work and Life. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm Mary Cranston, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you are in the know, is adjourned.